It's so evident that we live in a day and age that is unlike any that has been since the beginning of the creation. When you just travel around and you look and you see people walking around the airports with their cell phones, and imagine what anybody 100 years ago would have thought if they were just dropped in the middle of an airport today. It's mind-boggling. The increase in knowledge, the increase in technology, the incredible comforts that we enjoy in this day and age. The people that are in the poorest classes today live virtually like kings would have in the past. The amount of wealth that is shared abundant in this country and so many others. This is a unique time in history. Nothing like this day and age has been seen in the centuries and the millennia that man has been on earth. And yet, there are some things about us today that are just the same as man has ever been. Some things just never change. I'd like to ask you, what was the world like in the 1400s? The 1400s. Now, think back a little bit on your knowledge of that day and age. And I'm talking about the world of the Western world. I'm not talking about the Far East in Asia, China. Something that would be closer to our, you know, familiarity zone, our cultural heritage, the Western world, Europe, the Middle East, and so on. What would your worldview be if you lived during that period of time in the 1400s? We're only talking 600 years ago, after all. Now, if you were coming to that time from ours today, you'd probably be missing indoor plumbing and a lot of electricity. But I'm not talking about having what is from our day and age inflict our times and knowledge onto that day. Just think about what you would think, what you would know, what your world would be living in the 1400s. I mean, Thomas Edison's a long way ahead yet. Never heard of him. All that produced. If you were a Christian living in Spain or in England at that time, what would be your view of, let's say, prophecy? I mean, we have a worldview today that's informed by our understanding of world events as well as the scriptures, and we have a worldview that is influenced and informed by our understanding of prophecy, don't we? So when we look at what's taking place in the world, we filter it through the scriptures and our understanding, and that gives us a certain worldview. What would be your worldview as a Christian living in the 1400s? Let me set the stage a little bit. The United States has been a country for how long? 250 years or so, right? During that time that we have been a nation, we have waged many wars against many countries. We've fought against England. We've fought against Spain. We've fought against Mexico. We've fought against Vietnam or in Vietnam. We've fought in Korea. We've fought the Barbary pirates. We've fought Russia. We've fought Italy. We've fought Germany. We've fought Japan. It's a long list, isn't it? We fought a Cold War against Russia that lasted for some 60 years. We're now fighting a war against terror. We're in about 10th year or so of the war against terror. And we've even fought against ourselves in a bloody civil war, North against South. Most of these wars that I've mentioned lasted just a few years and were done. Within 4, 5, 6, 10 years, most of those wars were started, fought, and ended. Now, not all of them. Some seem to drag on interminably. The longest of them, the Cold War against Russia, of course, for, like I said, about 60 years. That war defined a whole generation, and it shaped our view, our worldview as a society, and not just in our country, but virtually worldwide. It shaped a certain worldview when the great powers of this earth were locked in this great Cold War. So we understand how these things can shape and inform our worldviews today, this day and age. But now imagine that you live in Spain in the 1400s. Your country has been at war with the Moors for as long as anyone in your family can remember. Hundreds of years. Not a war that lasts 3 or 4 or 5 years and it's done. This war has been going on for as long as anyone in your family can consider. Hundreds of years. You can't talk to anybody in your family or in anybody's family that doesn't remember fighting against the Moors. The Reconquista, as it was called, the reconquest against the Muslim rulers in your land, has been going on and on and on. It just defines what you do. In the 1400s in Spain, you're just now beginning to best the Moors. 1492, they were finally totally ousted by Ferdinand and Isabella, conquered, and Spanish Peninsula was regained again for the Spaniards and for Catholicism, Christianity. But things at that point in time were not going so well in Jerusalem. For 300 years, that's longer than the United States has been a country, for 300 years, the Crusades have been waged to try and free the Holy Land for safe passage of Christian pilgrims to the sites, the holy sites, in and around Jerusalem in the Middle East. 300 years. And that is only a part of a longer battle that has been going on with Islam already for 800 years. What's your worldview like? Think about that. The Spanish Inquisition has also now started on all of those who were not Catholic in Spain, all of them, Jewish, Muslim, and anyone else who's not Catholic. Imagine that. All you have to be is not Catholic, and you are living in danger of the Spanish Inquisition. How does that shape your worldview every day when you get up in the morning? And if you're a Christian at that time, and I'm not speaking in the terms of Catholic Christian, but a non-Catholic Christian, how do you view prophecy now? There is this incredibly dominant, powerful Pope being aligned with very powerful kings, bringing all kinds of heresy, as you might see it, fear and destruction, all taking place within the context of a war that has been ongoing for 800 years and is centered now in the environs of Jerusalem, where you know Christ is to return. How might that shape your view and understanding of where you are in prophecy? Can you think about that? Where do you see yourself? It's easy to say that a non-Catholic Christian might well be seeing himself in the end times, wouldn't you say? But what of the Catholic? Where would a Catholic see himself through the eyes of prophecy? Where would his worldview be? I'd like you to consider the writings and the travels of a man that is familiar to all of us by name, certainly, not by, obviously, personal note, because he lived in the 1400s and the 1500s. But you all know his name. You know it well. His name is Christopher Columbus, who in 1492 sailed the ocean blue and, you know, found America. And actually, he never set foot on what we know as America. He never landed or touched the soil of North America. He was in the Caribbean, the West Indies, and that territory. But he opened the way. He opened the passageway for a dramatically changed world by his discoveries and sailings, didn't he? The world was different after Columbus. But I'd like you to consider his writings And these might not be some of the writings that you've studied when you were in school, for example. I was talking with my son David just today, as a matter of fact, because I told him I was going to be speaking about Columbus. He said, "Oh, Columbus, I just studied him for a month at school. I know everything about Columbus." But I bet his teachers never talked to him about some of the things that we're going to look at. Because they studied the actions of Columbus, but how many of the writings of Columbus do they study? He landed in the New World on October the 12th of 1492. Columbus was a very devout Catholic. He observed all the fasts of the church. He prayed daily, multiple times a day. His very name, Christopher, means Christ-bearer. And he saw that, he understood that as a title that indicated what his destiny and calling was. He saw himself as one who was responsible, one who was obligated, and even prophesied in the scripture, to be the one to bear Christ into the new world. He was a Christ bearer. That's how he saw himself. He diligently searched the scriptures, and he thought he found assurance for a call of God to sail to the far reaches of the globe with the Christian message. Zechariah chapter 9, verse 10. Zechariah 9, verse 10 said that, quote, "He shall speak peace unto the heathen, and his dominion shall be from sea even to sea, and from the river even to the ends of the earth." What was he doing? He was going to the ends of the earth, to the heathen. So he saw himself in this scripture. Psalm 107, verses 23 and 24. Psalm 107, verses 23 and 24 promised that, quote, "They that go down to the sea in ships, that do business in great waters, these see the works of the Lord and his wonders in the deep." And his journeys certainly gave him much opportunity to see the wonders of God, the deliverance from the storms and from possible mutinies and different things like he saw the wonders of God in all of that and in the deliverance of the gospel to the heathen. Columbus was particularly concerned at that time about another problem, though, in the other direction. And what was that? He was a Catholic, a Christian. He and his faith were threatened by the powers of Islam, the Ottoman Empire, particularly in the West, the Turks, who had already taken Byzantium, all of Asia Minor, and taken back again the holy places, and there was a continual battle there. And he was concerned with the power of the Ottoman Turks that controlled the eastern Mediterranean and were indeed threatening all of Europe. They would continue to threaten Europe until the 1600s. 1,000 years. 1,000 years of unrelenting turmoil between Christians and Muslims. And the continual expansion of Islam through what had been formerly Christian lands. From 610, when Muhammad got his visions, into the Spanish Peninsula, the taking of all of Spain virtually, and up to parts of France, by the early 1700s, just 100 years. And then an expansion, they were stopped there by Charles Martel and bottled up, you could say, in the Iberian Peninsula, in the territory of Spain, until Ferdinand and Isabella in the 1400s. But on the east, the Muslims went all through the old Eastern Roman Empire, Byzantium, conquered that. And destroyed them to the point where the patriarch of Constantinople issued a plea to all Christians throughout the world to please help because they were about to be wiped out. Christianity was about to be wiped out in the East. And the response was what we know as the Crusades. Christians of the West riding to try to liberate and free the territories being taken by the Muslims. The Crusades waged for hundreds of years. And now in the 1400s, again with Jerusalem in the hands of the Muslims, there was still turmoil there. So Columbus was concerned about this worldwide battle that had been going on. You know, the Cold War between the United States and Russia lasted for about 60 years, where the whole world was kind of locked in, what's going to happen here? This was a battle that had been waging for 800 to close to 1,000 years by the time it was really the tables turned. But Columbus thought that perhaps if a way could be found of reaching India by sailing to the west, that the Turks could be attacked from behind, and perhaps the Holy Land itself then could be rescued from their hands. Because the Turks blockaded the way to the Holy Land by land from Europe. So if you could sail to the west, you could get to them from the rear. And that motivated his desire to seek out this passage. When land was sighted on October the 12th of 1492, in recognition of the divine aid that he recognized on his voyage, Columbus named the land San Salvador, our Savior. That's what it means, the Holy Savior. And he prayed and he thanked God. Now, I want you to consider something for a minute. We were talking in the sermonette about the courage, the fortitude, the determination that it takes to set out on great deeds and things like that. Columbus left with three ships, the Pinta, the Nina, and the Santa Maria. David and I had a chance to go whale watching while we were out in Monterey at the feast. We got on a 65-foot boat. We went out there in the swells, you know, and we found a whale, and we had a great time. But, you know, that boat went out in the little bit of the Pacific Ocean that we were on. You know, the swells, 10-foot or whatever, that boat can smack down sometimes. Do you know how big the Santa Maria was? That was the largest of his ships. It was 70 feet. Our whale-watching boat was 65 feet. The next largest of his ships was the Pinta, which was the same size as our whale-watching boat, 65 feet. The Nina was 45 feet. And he sailed across the ocean in those three little buckets in search of a passage where he could make a way to hopefully get to the rear of the Muslims and take the Holy Land from that side. On the way, he was going to spread the gospel wherever he went. That was his aim, religiously speaking. He prayed for that continuously. Columbus believed that his discovery of the New World was necessary in order to fulfill an ancient prophecy. In about 1500, he wrote about America in one of his famous letters. And he to quote, it said this, "God made me the messenger of the new heaven and the new earth of which he spoke in the Apocalypse of St. John after having spoken of it through the mouth of Isaiah, and he showed me the spot where to find it." Columbus produced a famous book that he called the Book of Prophecies. Do you know that? Columbus wrote a Book of Prophecies. Contained over 200 biblical and patristic passages, you know, quotes from the founding fathers of Christianity and prophets down through the ages, as well as biblical passages. And he compiled them all to give basically an explanation of his worldview and why he did what he did, what motivated him, what drove him, how he saw things. And they were clearly within this biblical, prophetic worldview. Columbus made his case in order to win support from both the Vatican and from the Spanish monarchs, Ferdinand and Isabella, the Catholic monarchs. At the center of his appeal to them was a millennial prophecy about the destiny of the land that he would discover. A new world, he said, was to arise in the West to fight a final crusade against the Arab powers of the Middle East. The Book of Prophecies is a compilation of different revelations written by Columbus toward the end of his life, and it conveys the notion that was common during the medieval period that in order for the end of the world or for the second coming of Jesus Christ to occur, certain events need to happen. Now, do we also recognize that there is a need for certain events to happen before Christ is going to return the second time? Of course we do. Well, he recognized that. Many people through the ages have recognized that. Here were the things that he was looking at that were necessary fulfillments before Christ's second coming. Number one, Christianity must be spread throughout the world. Now, do we not feel the same? The gospel will be preached through all the world and then the end will come, right? Columbus knew that. He knew it had to be preached through all the world. So therefore, if he didn't get on those three little buckets and sail across the Atlantic Ocean, how were the heathen to get the gospel message? He had to do that for the end to come. That was his first point. Secondly, the Garden of Eden, he said, must be found. Okay, well, we're not looking for that, are we? But there was a common idea in his day that the Garden of Eden must be found. It was the belief in the Middle Ages that the biblical Garden of Eden must have been on the top of some crag or mountaintop so that it would not have been affected by the destruction of the world by Noah's flood. I don't know where that idea came from, but that was a common belief in his day, and so he said that that needed to be. And some speculate that when he found the mountains of Venezuela, he was expecting to maybe find where the Garden of Eden might be on top of those mountains. I don't know about that, but some have speculated that. Third point, he said, that the last crusade must take back the Holy Land from the Muslims. It was also believed that when Christ comes, he will come back in the place that he lived and died, which of course was Jerusalem. We believe that when Christ returns, his feet will touch down on the Mount of Olives, don't we? We read that in the Minor Prophets. And when he returns, then the mount will cleave in two. And he will establish his government there from Jerusalem, and the law will go out from Jerusalem. And he understood the same prophecy. And so he thought Christ would return there, and if Christ was going to return there, then Jerusalem would have to be in the hands of his people. And so he expected that there would be a final battle. He called it a crusade to take back the Holy Land from those who then owned it and controlled it, the Muslims. There will be a final battle that will be centered around Jerusalem, won't there? He understood that as well. The fourth thing that he was looking at was that the last world emperor had to be chosen. Columbus had, at least in his own mind, identified that the Catholic monarchs of Ferdinand and Isabella would fulfill that position because of the incredible imperial power and for the religious conviction that they had. They were tremendously influential. They controlled so much. And they were deeply religious, and they thought, there's the last monarch before the return of Christ. It was his view. Columbus believed he was living within 150 years of the return of Jesus Christ. Now, 600 years have passed since then. Obviously, he was wrong. But it was his firm belief, based on his view of the world and his understanding of prophecy, that that's where he was in his day and age. The last world emperor, he believed, would be necessary to lead that last crusade against the Muslims and Greek Christ at Jerusalem once the previous three steps, had been completed. All of this is found in his book of prophecies. Now, how many of you knew that Columbus wrote a book of prophecies? One. You didn't learn that in school, did you? He was an incredibly religious man, and it motivated his journeys because he had a certain worldview. His book of prophecies collected passages from the Bible that inspired him as he planned his voyages. Proverbs chapter 8, verse 27, speaks of the earth's surface as being curved. He knew that. That was one of the passages that he took and said, the earth is curved, we're not going to fall off the end. You know, that's an idea that actually doesn't even show up until the 1800s, that there were people that believed that the earth was flat. He knew that the earth was a sphere, from Proverbs chapter 8, verse 27. Isaiah 40, verse 22 also refers to a spherical earth. He knew that. He quoted that. He would later describe his discovery of the New World as the fulfillment of what Isaiah prophesied from Isaiah chapter 24, verse 15, referring to the isles beyond the sea, and also Isaiah 60, verse 9. I'll give those scriptures again. You can look them up later, Isaiah 24, 15, Isaiah 60, verse 9. He was a man quite familiar with the scriptures. But even beyond the geographical evidence that he collected, both from Scripture and from the science of his day, the Book of Prophecies showed that he knew prophetic events, and he had a deep faith, and he had a mission. Columbus wanted nothing less than the universal conversion of Christ, to Christ of all people. On page 24 of the translation of his Book of Prophecies, he wrote, "The sons of Ishmael will be the leaders of the persecution of Christians in the final days of the world." Now, who are the sons of Ishmael? The Arabs. He saw them as the ones who would be the leaders of the persecution of Christians in the final days of the world. Well, guess what? For 800 years, they had been locked in this battle with the sons of Ishmael. Commentator on the Book of Prophecies wrote, "Columbus began to view the goal of the liberation of Jerusalem from Muslim domination in an apocalyptic sense. The discovery of the West Indies became identified in his mind with one of the events which would precede the end of the world, the universal conversion of the peoples to the gospel of Christ." Columbus was an incredible explorer and mariner, no question about it. But he was also an incredible student of the Scripture, and he took biblical passages very, very literally. To restore the Holy Land as a fulfillment of the prophecies of the book of Isaiah and elsewhere, of the end times, he believed that the gold from the New World could be used to finance the great crusade to the Middle East to regain Jerusalem. Now, most people are very well familiar with the desire of the Spanish monarchy for the gold that they anticipated finding in the New World. And they feel that was the big priority for them to expand. Oh, yes, they went and they wanted to convert the heathen that were there too, but they really wanted the gold. Spain was looking for the gold. Do you know why Spain was looking for the gold? Because it was expensive to send people to fight in Jerusalem. Their motivation was not just pure greed. Their motivation, again, came down to this worldview, this prophetic worldview that they had, that they were in a spiritual battle against forces that would lead to an end of the age event. They needed the gold to finance that. And it was part of Columbus's argument to the Spanish monarchs why they needed to invest in his journeys. And they gave him the permission to go do so. Columbus felt that the gold that he would find, which was widely rumored about, could be used to help finance this great battle against Islam. He did have a sense of millennial fulfillment, and he thought that from his voyages and discoveries, he saw the final capstone event of his career would be the final expedition to the Middle East as a fulfillment of the biblical prophecies that would lead to the millennium. I'd like to make a couple of quotes here from some professors. Bernard McGinn is a professor of historical theology and history of Christianity at the Divinity School of the University of Chicago. He wrote, in answer to the question, did Columbus see himself in apocalyptic terms? He said, "If we look at the history of Columbus and some of his writings, particularly his letters and in the Book of Prophecies that he put together, we can see that Columbus thought of himself very much in terms of that apocalyptic tradition. And he felt that his voyages of discovery were ushering in a millennial age, an age of a last world emperor, a Spanish last world emperor, who would recapture Jerusalem and initiate a messianic period. And he had studied prophecies very, very carefully as he put together his Book of Prophecies in order to sell his program to Ferdinand and Isabella. And it's not that he was using this, he believed it. He felt that they should believe it as well. His Book of Prophecies is a compilation of a whole range of prophecies from the Old and the New Testament, along with more current prophecies. What he's trying to do is to create a kind of handbook of prophecies that he can use in his attempts to get new funding from Ferdinand and Isabella. One of the prophecies that he fastens upon is that of a coming last emperor who will reconquer Jerusalem, who is very specifically a Spanish ruler. And we know that he ascribes this prophecy to a Spanish prophecy from the early part of the 14th century. How does Jerusalem begin to figure into Columbus's discovery of the New World? Another professor said, he felt that he was able to go around the world to get to Jerusalem. and the going around the world to get to Jerusalem would facilitate the conquest of Jerusalem by a Spanish last world emperor. The way to Jerusalem had been blocked by the Turks and others, but the gold that he felt he would discover in the Indies was the money that would be needed to mount the military expedition that would reconquer Jerusalem and issue in a universal messianic rule in which Christianity would triumph under the leadership of a Spanish last monarch. That was his worldview. It was a worldview which he tried to sell, if you will, to the Spanish monarchs. It was a worldview that you could see, based on what was happening throughout the world, made sense in their understanding. Here was this cataclysmic battle over Jerusalem. Over Jerusalem. What does the Bible tell us about what will be taking place in Jerusalem before the return of Jesus Christ? He had many substantial reasons to believe that he was living in the last days. So Columbus thought he was there. Now 600 years have passed. But you know, he wasn't the only one who believed he was living in the last days. William Miller, preacher popular in the 1800s in the United States. There was a great awakening that he inspired as he taught people and called them to repentance, to conversion to Christ, with the expectation of Christ's imminent return in the 1840s. When Christ didn't return, as a result of his preaching, there was what was called the Great Disappointment. People sold things, people didn't do things, they donned their robes and they waited on the hilltops because they expected Christ to return, and he didn't come. That was in the 1840s. Now, out of the Millerite movement, there are a number of fairly sizable denominations that have developed, including the Seventh-day Adventists and others that we know of today. And even our tradition can be traced back to much of what he taught. That was in the 1840s. Now, 160 years have passed. Even in the first century, Christians anticipated the imminent return of Jesus Christ in their day. We read about that in the scriptures, don't we? Now almost 2,000 years have passed from when the Christians then believed they were living in the last days. Christians in virtually every age since the time of Christ have believed that they were living in the last days. Well, sooner or later, someone's going to be right. Right? Because we know not when Christ will return, but we know he will. That prophecy is sure, isn't it? Sooner or later, someone's going to hit right on this, just, you know, because it's got to happen. The question is, are we living in the last days? Or is that the question? For a lot of people, that seems to be the big question. Are we living in the last days? But really, should that be our question? Because what difference does it make, after all, if we are living in the last days or not? Does it change anything about the way you're supposed to live? Not one bit, does it? Not one bit. We're supposed to be excited about the truth of God, whether we've got 5,000 years ahead or 5 hours ahead before the return of Jesus Christ. It shouldn't change what you do today one iota. Not one bit. So I hope that whether we're living in the last days or not, and our knowledge of that doesn't make a difference for how you live. Shouldn't be different. We should live motivated by the Spirit of God, not by an idea that Christ's return is within a very short period of time. Now, that's an exciting concept. I'm not denying that. And truly, the thought that Christ's return being close has driven people, even like Columbus, to great accomplishments. That's good. We should be driven by the anticipation of Christ's return to great accomplishments in our efforts to preach the gospel, to build his character, and to be prepared for that second coming. Whenever that comes, we should be driven by that. We should be excited by that. But if a Christian in Columbus' day knew that it was going to be at least another 600 years, at least, because we're down that road that far already, would it have changed how that Christian lived? Would it have changed how Columbus lived? Would it have caused him to say, oh, I know Christ isn't going to come back for at least 600 years, so I can't be the one in these prophecies, and therefore I'm not going to do this, and then what? Where would we be now? What about a Christian of the first century? If a Christian in the first century thought, no, it's going to be at least 2,000 years before Christ returns, would that have changed his motivation to live as a Christian ought to live? I hope not. What about a Christian in the 1840s? When William Miller preached, convinced many, got them all excited, and then Christ didn't come back on the date that he selected, or on the one that he selected the second time after he figured his calculations were wrong the first time. What happened to the multitudes? It was a giant movement throughout the United States, this great awakening. What happened to all of them when Christ didn't return as expected? Did their lives change? Did they live differently? Yes, they did. Most of them went back to just their old ways. Their, quote, conversion didn't stick. What were they converted to? Fear. They were converted to the idea, perhaps, that Christ's return was imminent. And when it wasn't, they no longer were converted? Is that what our conversion is founded on? I sincerely hope not. Because it doesn't matter if they were right or wrong about the day of his return. The requirement of God for us to yield ourselves to the guidance and influence of his Spirit, to do his will, to preach his gospel, to build his character, to lead a life that pleases him, doesn't change a bit. But they were focused on the wrong thing. Not on their growth, not on their character, not on the reality of Christ in them. They were focused on Christ in the air returning from heaven. So what if we're living in the last days? Or not? Does it change who you are? What happened in the 1840s when Christ didn't return was the great disappointment, and people relaxed and they slacked off. Let's take a minute to look at what's going on today. Did you read a newspaper this week? Listen to the radio? Watch the television? Did you see what's going on in Europe? I mean, really, have you seen what's going on in Europe? Look what's going on in the Eurozone. Greece had to change their prime minister because of what's going on in their economy and in the European economy. And not just Greece, Italy. We had two major prime ministers that had to give up their seats. Berlusconi's gone, Papandreou's gone. So that they can come under the work, the influence, the control of a central power in Europe. Is that not significant prophetically? Could that not be very significant prophetically? Do we not see what's going on there? And who is it that is the strong party in this partly weak and partly strong Europe? Is it not Germany? For the third time in less than 100 years, being the dominant power in the heart of Europe. Is that not significant prophetically? Are these things that can get us a little excited if we start to look at this? As our worldview, being informed by the scriptures, can teach us, inform us? What else has happened in the last week or two? Earthquakes in Oklahoma? Hello? Oklahoma. Texas. Oh, and yes, Japan, too. I wonder, do those qualify as diverse places according to Matthew chapter 24, the prophecy that there will be earthquakes in diverse places? And, you know, frequent ones here. Is that not a possible indication of where we are? Christ said that these things... Well, let's turn to Matthew chapter 24. Let's look at what he said here. Can we get a little excited about this? Matthew chapter 24 and verse 7. Excuse me. Matthew chapter 24. In answer to the question that was posed to him by the disciples, Christ said, and the question being, what will be the sign of your coming? The end of the age. Christ gave a number of signs, including, well, verse 4, take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many. Certainly, we can say that there is great deception within Christianity today. There's no question about that, is there? And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. Wow. Okay. How many wars did I list in the 250-year history just of the United States? Have we not heard of wars and rumors of wars? And are they not even abundant today? Last I heard, you know, Israel was saying that an attack against Iran is on the table. There's a rumor. Last I heard, Iran is continually saying an attack on anybody is on the table. Wars and rumors of wars. But he said, see that you're not troubled, for all of these things must come to pass, but the end, he said, is not yet. For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom. I don't know, do two world wars count for that? Is there another one yet on the horizon? And there will be famines and pestilences, and, oh yes, earthquakes in various diverse places. We've seen these things, haven't we? So what? Earthquakes in Oklahoma, do they count? Maybe so. What else do we see as we look at what's going on today? We see the U.S. economy and our U.S. politics and our U.S. social conditions all in a state of turmoil and many would say decline. It's incredible how many people are saying that the best days of the United States are behind us. And we are a nation in decline, and we have to see others come step to the plate in all kinds of areas. It's not hiding. It's interesting, I read this past week that there are those now who think it's the right time to try to repeal the Defense of Marriage Act. Does that not speak to our social conditions? We can't even define marriage as a union between husband and wife, man and woman. Now they're going to repeal that? Does that speak to where we are as a people, morally, socially? Does this not describe what we read in Isaiah chapter 5 about those that would call good evil and evil good? Do we not see this as we look in our world today? What else do we see as we look around at what's going on? The Arab Spring. This last year, we've seen governments fall throughout the Arab world. It's brought huge change. And Western-oriented leaders are not the ones that are filling the void that has been created in leadership in those positions. Does that not have implication for the instability that may be there in the future of our world? What else do we see? I mentioned earlier, Iran is thumbing its nose at the world and rattling what it anticipates to be soon, at least, a nuclear saber. And Israel now putting the possibility of a strike on the table. Is that chilling for the implications of what could happen as a result of that? Are we not living very evidently in an age when knowledge is increased and people are running to and fro? Daniel chapter 12. Daniel chapter 12. If there is any single verse in Scripture that describes our day, I don't know what can describe our day better than Daniel chapter 12 and verse 4. where it says, "But you, Daniel, shut up the words and seal the book until the time of when? Of the end." And it says, "For many shall run to and fro, and knowledge shall be increased." You know, I've been through three different airports in this last week. Tell me people aren't running to and fro. As I was descending into the Tucson airport, the person next to me looked out the window and looked at I-10 and said, "Wow, that's a busy place. Are people not running to and fro all over I-10 and down?" Do we not see that there has never been an age when people run to and fro like today? Is this not an age when knowledge is increased? Go to a library or just turn on the internet. There is so much information, so much knowledge out there. You could sit in front of your computer screen just soaking it in like Data, you know, from Star Trek. Just like this, continually soaking in all the knowledge. For how long? I think endlessly. Knowledge has been increased to such an incredible degree today. Does this not describe what Daniel prophesied to be conditional at the time of the end? Boy, it sure does. We could probably continue to go on, couldn't we, about these types of things. We know without a doubt that we are living in the days of the prophesied fourth beast of Daniel and his writings in the book of Daniel prophetically. And how many beasts, after all, were there before the return of Christ? Four. There's no question that we're living in the days of the fourth beast. The final one before the return of Jesus Christ. Now, can you and I get excited about the possibility, or let me rephrase that, about even the likelihood that we are living in the last days? Boy, I think so. But how long do we have yet to go in these last days? It's an incredible time that we're living in. Let's go back to Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24. I'm going to pick it up in verse 21. Excuse me. Matthew 24, verse 21 says, "For then there will be great tribulation, such as has not been since the beginning of the world until this time, no, nor ever shall be." That is a chilling statement. Tribulation such as has never been in the history of the world or ever would be again. I have not lived during that period of time or fought in wars. I've been tremendously blessed. I've lived in an era of peace in the most wealthy, blessed country on the face of the earth. Some of you have been in war, World Wars II or later, and you know what war is like. You can look at the reports, documentaries about what war was like in World War II or in Vietnam when they just spread the napalm. And you can imagine there's coming a time of tribulation and difficulty that is going to be more severe, more horrendous than the wars that we've seen in the last century. That's almost mind-boggling. That's just amazing, isn't it? If that isn't a chilling thought, I don't know what is. But the mind of man, stirred up by his evil desires, with Satan as the god of this world and the prince of the power of the air inspiring these things, will bring this time to bear. How close are we to that time? Look at the instability in the world right now. Look at the power militarily that is spread out throughout the world right now, not controlled in just the hands of a few, as it was, relatively speaking, during the time of the Cold War. We have atrocious weapons that are now spread into the hands of many individuals. Continuing, it says in verse 22, that unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened. Thank God. that he is on his throne, and he will shorten the days that would otherwise cause man to annihilate himself. Without God, we would have no hope. We've returned just recently from the Feast of Tabernacles, last great day, that time when we celebrate the coming of Jesus Christ and the end of man's rule, because man's rule is bringing us to what end? 6,000 years and we have not learned the ways of peace. We haven't. We have intractable problems in our world today. I don't care who's elected in the next election cycle, they're not going to solve our problems. They're not. Because our problems are not solvable in this human reign with the influence of Satan. They're just not. We need the return of Jesus Christ. That's why we celebrate the way we do every fall, the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of Trumpets and his return and all that that will bring for us. If that is not our hope, we are without hope for this world, isn't it? But Christ, God, will shorten those days. Verse 23, if anyone says to you, look, here is the Christ, or there, don't believe it. For there will be false Christs and false prophets that will arise and show great signs and wonders to deceive, if possible, even the elect. Even the elect will have their eyes turned to deception, or possibly so. If even the elect will be threatened with this turning away, getting their eyes focused on everything but what is important, that is a warning to each and every one of us, isn't it? We need to stay focused on the things that will truly matter. Now, let me ask you the question. If Christ returns this week or this month or in the year 2050, does it matter? Does it matter with what you're going to do in your life today? So is that where we need to focus? I'm not saying we can't be pretty excited about it. But is that where our heart is, or is our heart in the Christianity that we've been called to live? Don't be among those who will be deceived. Because even the elect will be potential casualties of that deception. See, he said, I have told you beforehand. We are warned. Therefore, if they say to you, look, he is in the desert, don't go out to the desert. Or look, he's in the inner rooms, don't believe it. For as the lightning comes from the east and flashes to the west, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man. There will be no question in anybody's mind when he returns. None. So if somebody says he's here already, tell him to go take a whale watching trip. Go away, because, you know, it's not so. Right? When Christ returns, every eye will see that event. And if you're telling me he's here already, it ain't so. Sorry. That's what Christ himself said. For wherever the carcass is, there the angels will be gathered together. Verse 29, immediately after the tribulation of those days, and we've already seen that those days are going to be tribulation that is just astonishing. Then the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light. The stars will fall from heaven and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. Can you imagine that? And the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven. And then all of the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. And you read in Acts chapter 1 and 2 about the time when Christ went into heaven, and the disciples were standing there gazing up into heaven, as you probably would be too, and your jaw probably dropped down around your knees, you know, wow. And the angels said to them, just as you've seen him go, you'll see him come again. Well, that's what Christ said here in Matthew 24. He's coming in power in the clouds of the heaven, just the same way. Scripture is consistent in this regard. Verse 31, and he will send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they will gather together his elect from the four winds from one end of heaven to the other. It's what we celebrated at the fall festivals, wasn't it? The return of Jesus Christ and the coming kingdom of peace that he will establish. Verse 32, now learn this parable from the fig tree. Because up to this point, Christ gave a lot of things that he said would happen. But he said, learn this parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender and puts forth leaves, then you know that the summer is near. So you also, when you see all of these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. What's it? What was the question that the disciples asked? The sign of Christ's coming and the end of the age. When you see all of these things happening, know that it's near. I don't know what near means. I mean, I know what near means. Near means it's not far. I'll tell you a story. When I was sent as a ministerial assistant to Eastern Pennsylvania, I was from New York. My home congregation was in New York, and went to serve in the congregations in Pennsylvania. And the teens were thrilled because they wanted a trip to New York. And they said, now we have somebody who's from New York. We've got our own tour guide. Let's organize this trip to New York. So I said, great, I'm happy to do that. So we had, as it turned out, a caravan of seven vehicles, all traveling from eastern Pennsylvania. We were going to travel into Manhattan, drive around, see a few things, and then go out to Long Island and stay with members out there. And we were going to have several days in New York. It was going to be a great trip. Well, before we all got underway, I got together with the drivers. Remember, there were seven of us. And I said, look, when we get to New York, through New Jersey, we hit the tunnels, we've got to stay close. Because if we're not close, if we don't stay close, seven vehicles are going to end up scattered all over lower Manhattan. And everybody said, yeah, got it, absolutely. So we got there, and this was in the days, you know, before cell phones when we could keep in touch. We got to the tunnel to cross from New Jersey into Manhattan. We weren't even all into the tunnel before we were scattered. And by the time we all found each other again, which was quite a chore, I had come to a realization. Close to somebody from New York does not have the same definition as close to somebody from the rural parts of Pennsylvania. If you're driving in Pennsylvania and you can see them in front of you, you know, that's close enough. But if you're in New York, close means like this. One of the drivers came up to me afterward and he said, I have to tell you something. I'm never going to let that happen again. I am going to be like a bug on a bumper with you. That's how close I'm going to be. All right, so when Christ says it's near, it's close, are you from Manhattan or are you from Eastern Pennsylvania? I don't know. See, the term has a little bit of a variation in meaning, doesn't it? I don't know how close is in this regard. But he said it's close. It's not far. It's not out of view. That's the best I can do because he said no man knows the day or the hour. You don't know the day or the hour, and I don't know the day or the hour. We can look around and say, boy, everything that I see indicates that it's close. And I don't know about you, but that's pretty exciting. But it might not be close enough for me to live out my, you know, next couple of weeks before Christ returns. I might live out my lifetime. My kids might live out their lifetime, and it's still close. I mean, talk about a context of 7,000 years. What's 20 or 30? Does it make a difference if I knew, if Christ today told me or told you that, yeah, it's close, but by that I mean another 120 years. I mean, that's what it was for Noah, wasn't it? He was a preacher for 120 years. Would it change what you or I do today or tomorrow? Should it? Should it? So learn this parable of the fig tree. Know that it's summer is near, so also when you see all these things, verse 33, know that it's near, even at the doors. Assuredly, I say to you, this generation will by no means pass away until all of these things take place. That's close. One generation. And we can get all excited and say, one generation. Okay, what's a generation? Generation, depending on one definition, might be 20 years. You know, that's how long it takes for somebody who's born now to kind of get up to the age of adulthood when you start taking your place in, you know, a new generation shows up. Biblically speaking, we usually refer to a generation at about 40 years. But you know, there's this phrase, the generation of man. And that one so far is about 6,000 years. So what generation definition are we going to use here? Generation in the original is from the word genero, G-E-N-E-R-O, and it means to beget. So it's that age, it's that generation that has been begotten around a certain time by, you know, give them their lifespan, whatever that might be. Is that the generation? That's 70 years, if we're talking about it in that context. So it could be an age or a period or a cycle of things. The ISBE says that one definition of this word generation is the people of any period born at about the same time. Well, how big a period? I don't know. What period are we talking about? And about the same time. There are questions that we have. You see, Christ, as specific as he was about so many of these prophecies, left room for question, didn't he? We don't know the day or the hour. But he said it could be close. And this generation wouldn't pass until these things have all taken place. He said, verse 35, heaven and earth will pass away, but my words will by no means pass away. But of that day and hour, no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only. No one. So what are we going to spend all our time and effort focusing on? Verse 42, let's drop down a little bit. He said, you know all of this? This is my answer to you. So he said, watch, therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. Watch. Now, I think sometimes we take this encouragement to watch in exactly the opposite of the way that Christ intended it. Because so many times we say, watch what? Watch world events. Watch those leaves popping out on the fig tree. But you know what? If that were the case, why would he say, watch therefore, for you don't know what hour your Lord is coming? Wouldn't that be watch so that you know what hour your Lord is coming? What are we supposed to be watching? If no man can know the day or the hour, which is what he said, the only thing you and I can watch that's going to have any meaningful result is that we have to watch our spiritual readiness. Watch our spiritual readiness. Because we don't know the day or the hour, so we just have to watch and be ready whenever that time comes. How do we know we'll be ready when that time comes? It's not going to be because we've made some calculations and figured out a day or an hour or at least a week-long time period when it's going to be possible. Is one's going to be in the field, or two are going to be in the field, and one's going to be taken, the other not. Christ used the example of Noah when he said that there were those that were marrying, giving in marriage, and no one knew until the rains came. Noah just needed to be ready. He needed to have the ark prepared when God said, okay, Noah, get in the ark. I'm boarding it up. If he wasn't ready, then it didn't matter what else he was watching at all. We need to watch our spiritual readiness, our character growth and development, our use of God's Holy Spirit. That's the only thing we have control over that we can validly be watching. It's interesting that what follows here are some examples in terms of how to watch. He gives the example in chapter 25, first of the 10 virgins, the 5 that were ready and the 5 that weren't. They all slept, but 5 had watched their oil sufficiently to be prepared when that alarm was sounded, and they were ready. So who was watching and who was not? And what were they watching? None of them were watching by the window to see the arrival of the bridegroom. But the 5 that were not foolish had watched to make sure their oil was not drained. That's what they were able to watch and had control over. They had no control over when the bridegroom was going to come. They did have control over watching their oil level. Then the next parable that's given here, parable of the talents. Talents were given to servants, and they went out and they either multiplied the talents or they didn't multiply the talents, and then the one who had given them the talents came back again and asked for an accounting. What were they watching? To see when the master would return for the accounting? Or were they watching how they were utilizing the talents? They were watching how they were utilizing the talents. At least that's the lesson from this, isn't it? Because they didn't know when the master was going to return for the accounting. So what could they watch? They could watch the bank account. Then there's another parable that he gives here, beginning in verse 31 of chapter 25. When the Son of Man comes and all his holy angels with him, he'll sit on the throne of his glory and he's going to separate the sheep from the goats. Now, is there any indication here that we should watch about when the master comes? What were the individuals who were faithful sheep doing? They were watching out after one another, demonstrating and exercising the love of God shed abroad in their hearts and in their families and in their church. That's what they were watching. And they were the ones who were counted as the sheep and were rewarded. Those that were not watching, who were not being careful, were the goats. But none of them were watching to see when the master would come. They were watching what they were doing with what God had given them to do. What are we to be watching? Watch you, therefore, that you might be accounted worthy to escape all these things. Not watch that you might know when all these things are going to come to pass. Watch that you might be worthy to escape all these things. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 13 with me. 1 Corinthians chapter 13. We know this as the love chapter. I think it's an interesting passage to look at in this context. 1 Corinthians chapter 13 says in verse 1, though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but if I have not love, then I have become sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. What good is it? If you don't have love, what good is it? And though I have the gift of prophecy, what's that? I can know prophecy inside out. I can write a book of prophecy. And though I understand all mysteries, I can calculate the date and the time. That's a mystery. And all knowledge. And though I have all faith, boy, I wish I could say that I had all faith so that I could remove mountains. I'm not even close to that one, brethren. I'm sorry, your pastor falls down on this regard. I wish. But even if I had all faith that I could remove mountains, but if I have not love, then guess what? Nothing. What can I watch? What can you do? What can I do? Though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, though I give my body to be burned, but if I have not love, it profits me nothing. Drop down to verse, verse 13. Now abides faith, hope, and love. These three, but the greatest of these is love. Love never fails. But it's interesting, it says in verse 2 here, that prophecy, you know, will at some point. Verse 8, love never fails. But whether there are prophecies, they will fail. Whether there are tongues, they will cease. Whether there is knowledge, it will vanish away. Love never fails. What are you watching? What are we watching? 1 Corinthians chapter 8. We want to know, don't we, what's going on in the world. And I'm not saying we should be ignorant of it. Don't get me wrong. We should be seeing what's going on. We should acknowledge what's going on. We should understand it, and we should cry aloud with like a trumpet warning when we see things that are not right. It's part of our requirement as watchmen to give that warning. It's part of our requirement to carry a gospel, a good news message to the world. We have to be doing those things. But what does it say in chapter 8, verse 1? Concerning things offered to idols, we know that we all have knowledge. But knowledge does what? Puffs up. But what edifies? Love. We need to make sure that the Spirit of God and the fruits of the Spirit of God are what we are developing. That's the talent that we need to be using and growing in. And we need to be building the body of Christ and the work that God is doing in and among us. Again, don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that we shouldn't get excited about the things that we see going on in the world. There are tremendously, I think, significant things that we see happening. Let's not, though, get distracted by those things and neglect what is essential. We need to be exercising and living by the Spirit of God every day. That's primary. That's eternal. And that's what you and I can watch diligently so that we will be ready and will be counted worthy. You know, in 2 Timothy chapter 3, 2 Timothy chapter 3, we read in verse 1 that we can know this, that in the last days, perilous times will come. Now, did Columbus think that he was living in perilous times? You bet he did. He saw what was going on in Jerusalem. He knew that there were armies, you know, surrounding and controlling and all kinds of things. And he wanted to do what he could to prepare the way for the millennial return of Jesus Christ. He did it the way he thought that he knew best. And I think we're all beneficiaries of that. We're glad for that. But you know what? There have been perilous times as long as there has been a Satan around to stir up problems and trouble between people. There will be perilous times all the way up until the return of Jesus Christ and the changed human hearts through conversion that will result after his return. But will there be perilous times at the end of the age? Hugely. The end of the age in the last days, there are going to be perilous times that will come. For men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. Boy, does that not describe an age that we live in today. Having a form of godliness, but denying the power thereof. Does that not describe how so many people see and act on their supposed religiosity and Christianity? Verse 6, for of this sort are those who creep into households, make captives, gullible women loaded down with sins, led away by various lusts, etc. Always learning, but never able to come to the knowledge of the truth. We can be always learning and always looking and always watching for all the wrong things. We need to stay focused on that which is eternal. What is it that never fails? What is it that is eternal? Let's give ourselves to that first and foremost. You know, we have abundant opportunity, don't we, to demonstrate the love of God, the patience of God, the gentleness of God, all the fruits of God's Spirit. Let's look on these things and let's be counted worthy. We're living in perilous times. But, you know, one of the signs of the end is also that the natural affection of mankind is going to be changed. Let that never be said of the people of God. Let us live by and exemplify God's Spirit in and through us, and so be an example, a bright and burning light to this dangerously dark and evil world.